It's a great pleasure to be here and talk to many of you and for quite some time. So I'm not sure how much of this talk I'll be able to cover, so if I'm going too long, please, of course, don't hesitate to stop me or ask questions. So I couldn't help but noticing when I came in that there's this museum, which looks very interesting. I've never been there, actually. I've been here already 4 times. Apparently, it looks like on the inside, it looks like this. So anyway, a large fraction of what I'm going to talk about today was motivated thinking about glasses, as Luke was saying. Okay, so this work was done alongside with some of my former students and also with my longtime collaborator, Flavio Nogueira, and also experimentalist in our department, Ken Kelton. So I apologize. And so described in these papers and so on. So let me just get to the punchline, the problem that we actually have. So in many different arenas of physics, not only glasses per se, but also in quantum electronic systems and many other systems, we have many, many competing states or possibilities, and we really don't know which one to think about. So in many cases, especially in quantum electronic systems, many different phases that look very, very different from one another, they have a very, very small energy difference. So you might do a simulation and you might claim that you find, say, stripes in some system and so on. Somebody else might do a simulation and find another very, very different phase. And really, the energy difference is sort of minuscule. And this has been a problem that's been around for quite some time. And this sort of landscape of having many, many different states of universe, some energy, or free energy, is really an interesting one and, of course, a very, very challenging one. And one of the problems that appears is that we have sort of no obvious soft modes. In some vague sense, we have this landscape, we have different possibilities. It's not that we can easily go in our mind from one phase to another. We have to think about this problem more deeply. Okay, so before I run out of time, I'll just again tell you what my conclusion is, so to speak. So my conclusion is when you form I'm not going to prove it, it is sort of a viewpoint that hopefully is indeed the one that happens, right? Might not be, of course, the right one, is when we actually form a glass, in which case we take a fluid and we cool down very, very quickly, there's no conventional transition per se. You say there's no real transition. What happens is that we have a traditional sort of usual melting or freezing, depending on which way you go, from the liquid to the solid, but it's sort of rounded off. So basically, instead of actually having it being this sharp sort of transition that we typically see in equilibrium, in this case, when we cool things down very, very quickly, as I'll explain to you in more detail, what might happen is that it's sort of rounded off and we have a smearing of some sort. And as a result, things behave in a different way. We don't have a clear liquid type feature. We don't have a clear solid type feature. They look a bit of both. It's sort of perplexing and so on. But if we just allow for a small smearing, it seems we can explain perhaps many features. Okay, so that's basically the suggestion. And in this case, the only important temperature scale is not some exotic new temperature associated with an ideal glass or some other phenomena. It's basically the old usual one that we're accustomed to, namely the usual one we know from equilibrium. So in this case, from transition from a fluid to a solid would be the melting temperature of a usual solid. Okay, there's nothing unusual, no additional temperature scales are brought into the problem. If it be other phases you're thinking about, that you're going from one phase to another phase, rim phase, it would be that energy scale, temperature scale, which that transition occurs in equilibrium. Now we're just sort of smear it out. That's the suggestion. Okay, so, and as I'll suggest to you yet again, the continuation of that, as when you drive a system by varying its energy density, basically making temperature go up or down, or by applying pressure or external fields and so on, and then do it in a non-adiabatic fashion, what might happen is that you will have unusual, relative to what we teach our usually our students, long-range correlations. It will not decay as an exponential of some length scale, nor will it be simple power laws that we're accustomed to, but they might really be truly long-range. It might extend over the size of the sample that you're thinking about. It's that sort of in context where we always think about usual field theories and theories and usual correlations that decay in the worst case and in the best case, depending on how you look at it, algebraically, but perhaps can even be longer range than that when we deal with theories that describe systems that are inherently driven. So that's a suggestion. And why do we think about this? Because this is sort of a cartoonish picture I have in mind, which I'll explain to you in more detail throughout the talk. But before I go through the talk itself, let me just motivate what I'm thinking about. So if you take any system in equilibrium, and you look at any one of its dynamic quantities, like pressure, energy density, number density, and so on, they're always very, very sharp. So all intensive quantities that you have describing an equilibrium system are sharp. The fluctuations decay to zero in the thermodynamic limit. It might decay as 1 over square root of n, it might decay like 1 over n. Whatever you have, it must decay to zero in equilibrium. It's really, really sharp. It's a state variable defining the system. Okay, so what appears here on the right hand side, your left hand side, describes as say a system is an energy density. This is supposed to be cardinal delta function, a very, very narrow one. Describe a system in equilibrium when it has a very, very narrow distribution. Basically, for large systems, this width veers to zero. Okay? This is a usual case. Now imagine that you drive a system. Suppose you apply fields or you couple to some bath and so on, and you ask what happens. So clearly, of course, if a temperature goes up or down, by definition, in a sense, in almost all cases, the temperature, the energy density must also go up or down correspondingly. Okay, so if I say cool the system from this initial state, the energy density, the energy, say, per particle, the way I'm defining it here, must go down. Okay, but the suggestion is that it need not only go down in the main delta function. It might do that, but generically, it doesn't have to do that. It might also broaden. Okay, so you can take this initial state, defining the initial state system in equilibrium. You might give it a kick, so to speak, to make it go down in energy, to cool down or make it hotter if you want to give it heat going to the system. And now, generically, perhaps, you might have a non-trivial width. So instead of having equilibrium, this width is zero, essentially, this width now might become non-vanishing. That's the suggestion. Okay? And then, of course, if you wait long enough, you couple to a heat bath and you wait long enough depending on the details of the system, but if it goes back to equilibrium, heat bath at the corresponding temperature to which it actually goes to in the end, and energy density, it will again, once again, go to a delta function. Okay? So if there are no barriers to surmount, this might happen very, very quickly. It might happen almost immediately, especially if it's a very, very small system, it almost immediately will thermalize in most cases. On the other hand, if you have a system which doesn't thermalize very readily, this might take some time, perhaps. Okay? But regardless, as I drive a system, not only does the average value of the quantity that I'm driving change by fiat, but also the width, the standard deviation, might become non-zero. If you want to think about it in another intuitive way, you think about this as like a wave packet, like a delta function wave packet, you give it a kick along this axis, and as you give it a kick, it of course drifts along this axis, but not only that, it also diffuses and it has a non-trivial, say non-vanishing width, which ultimately by coupling it to some heat bath and so on, might become vanishing yet again. That's the suggestion, okay? Now why does this lead to non-trivial correlation? If this is true, of course, why does this imply non-trivial correlations? Because as I assume most of you know or already have thought about, if I write down longhand a generic Hamiltonian, suppose what most of you like to do, you think about some short range system, of course it doesn't have to be short range, real systems are not necessarily really short range, but let's nonetheless think about a system with short range. So suppose I write down my Hamiltonian as a sum of local operators, H sub R, these operators have their special support on some small finite volume of space. If I write out longhand what is the variance of energy, it will of course correspond to the sum of connected quotient functions. So I just have a value of this local Hamiltonian site R, site R prime minus corresponding averages of each one individually multiplied. In other words, it's a usual two-point correlator. And this, if this quantity scales the system size, this thing scales as n squared. If sigma e, the standard deviation, scales as n, so energy density scales as 1, this must go as n squared. In other words, this the average of this quantity over all pairs of sites must be of order 1. Doesn't matter how far you are in R prime R, this average must be of order 1. Okay, so this sounds a bit paradoxical. So, but of course, it's an inherent, these equations are of course what they are. There's nothing profound about them. But of course, you might argue, perhaps rightly, that what this picture is not correct. You might argue that it's impossible for a system to obtain a finite width, precisely for reasons that are sketched here. You might say, well, we know from all examples we studied thus far that the correlator always, two-point correlator versus connected correlator, always decays for large enough separations and so on. And therefore, the sum, if I average of all possible separations, respective of how far they are in space and so on, in my macroscopic sample, must veer to a value essentially of 0, and therefore this cannot be true. And this is something that I worried about for a very, very long time, and I convinced myself it's actually not a problem. In fact, that this is, it might really happen. And the remainder of the talk will be to motivate for you why this might happen. Any criticism will be welcomed greatly, okay? But this is essentially the punchline. Any questions about this? Okay, so if you have this picture of allowing the distribution to be broad and you just smear the usual equilibrium transition, then you can very easily, without introducing any additional parameters, any temperatures, you have only one number, which I'll explain to you what that is later on, which doesn't vary that much from all the different fluids we looked at. You can make a collapse of all the viscosity data for all fluids that have published viscosity data. So there are 57 fluids here. And you can collapse them onto one universal curve. This curve is the one predicted by the simple theory, which I'll explain to you what it is, in which the only important temperature scale is that of the equilibrium melting. So there's no black magic of some new temperature and so on, just a usual one from equilibrium, but now we allow us to have some broadening, and that broadening is additional parameter describing the system. It doesn't change actually that much from system to system, the way we derived it here. So let me explain what's plotted here. So here is the logarithm of this is all experiment. The viscosity temperature T for all these individual fluids, okay, divided by the viscosity at temperature T sub L. T sub L is a so-called liquidus temperature, but to avoid making it too complicated, just think about it as equilibrium melting. This is the usual equilibrium melting temperature, and so what I do is I look at the viscosity that I have measured at temperature T, divided by that one that I have temperature of equilibrium melting. I take the log of that, base 10, and I plot it as a function of this dimensionless ratio. This looks sort of like a reduced temperature, but it's not exactly reduced temperature. And this difference is important, even though we might argue it should be the same. It's actually not quite the same. This is how far, this is, remember, T sub L is a value of temperature at the equilibrium melting. So what we're doing here is we're measuring how far below melting we are, and we divide by temperature itself, not by the value of the transition temperature as we usually do for reduced temperatures.
So the normalized viscosity is the viscosity in the liquid phase.
Yes, exactly. So fluids that we just super cool. I'll explain to you what that is in later on. But basically, you take a fluid, and instead of actually having it melt, crystallize at the freezing temperature, you're just driving it down by cooling it down very, very quickly. And you measure as you do that, what is the viscosity? So you stop at some temperature and you measure the viscosity of that. And you keep doing it for many different temperatures, for many different fluids. And that's what these data come from. And this square root of 2 is just an artifact of the way we derive things. This number, A bar, is the only dimensionless number in this theory. And as I said before, but now quite a few times, doesn't vary that much from fluid to fluid. This varies by a factor of three across this entire spectrum, more or less. And as you can see, that most data, I mean, there are some outliers, clearly. This does not look very good, nor does this, nor does these points. But you should realize there are thousands of data points here. So what you see here that don't appear exactly in the line are the outliers, and there are not that many of them. So by and large, it seems that empirically, this fit is followed. Of course, it might not be followed for a reason of the theory that was initially produced for, but it's sort of a fact of nature that you can fit all the data that's published. There's also proprietary data that's not published from people, from companies that actually invent different glasses, and so like the Gorilla Glass and so on, but they won't tell you what the composition really is because it's proprietary, and they won't give you really the actual, they just give you some number, and there are only very few data points, so it's sort of useless to actually try to do that. But all, yeah.
What is Gorilla Glass?
It's a glass that's sort of strong. So Corning had this Gorilla Glass, a simple Gorilla Glass. Yeah, we have many different glass. So Corning gave us a few data points. They gave us only numbers. They didn't tell us what it was. It was a secret. They gave us 5 data points for each fluid. So it was not terribly useful for us. Okay, so basically, you can see it's all fits in one curve. Now, the same thing can be done not only for viscosity, but also for dielectric response data. So here we have 66 different fluids. And what we plot now is similar to what we did before, viscosity, but now we also have a time scale specifying the time on which things decay for dielectric response, we apply fields, and so on. Not we. People apply fields, and they report the data, and they report what the response time is. And again, it all falls onto the same universal curve. And again, there are a few outliers, but those are quite rare. And they seem, and these fits, as you can sort of see, they occur over 16 decades. So it seems to really occur over a substantial range. You could, of course, make this at reduced temperature, but then you have to add an additional parameter. So you actually have additional. In this way, there's only one number, and that number is one initially derived by the theory, which is just the width of this distribution. So now let me go back a little bit and tell you about, or remind you about glasses all too quickly. So glasses are all around you, of course, I mean, and so are glassy dynamics. Not all glasses are glasses of this type, even though it was what we were most accustomed to. They could be, so the ones that we're accustomed to have been around for millennia are silicate glasses, but also for organic glasses, including alcohols and so on, or metallic glasses. You can actually cool down metals very, very quickly and make them into glasses. They can have different uses. Also, electronic fluids can actually become metallic and exhibit glassy type features. So basically, this is a generic phenomena. And many of these, the important thing about glasses, which is typically not stated, because people like to think about it in an easy way, so you can relate to concepts with spin glasses and other fields and so on. But fundamentally, all these different systems have no disorder. Okay, so I can take any fluid that you like, let's say, or any crystal that you like, I can heat it up and melt it, okay, and I can cool it down fast enough, in principle, it might be very hard to do, but in principle, I can cool it down fast enough so it becomes a glass. And I didn't put in by hand any disorder. All the couplings and so on are uniform. There's nothing that sort of fluctuates in space and so on. It's all uniform. Okay, so glasses should not be confused with so-called spin glasses, even though they share many similar properties and they look quite similar. They are inherently different in this regard. The couplings describing the system have no disorder for glasses. Okay, and as I said a few times, I'm saying it again, it's a universal phenomenon. So all fluids, in principle, can exhibit it. And it might be hard to actually get there. You have to cool things down quickly enough. It's easy to cool things quickly for silicates. This has been around for millennia. But it's much harder to do for metals, and it's much harder to do for other systems, which like helium-4, it's really almost impossible to do. But nonetheless, as far as we know, it's always possible theoretically. Now, here's an example you can actually do in your kitchen or in your freezer. You can take, say, any fluid, like, say, water, and you can supercool it. So you can take a water bottle that has no impurities. So basically, it has to be clean. There's no impurities in the water bottle. OK? okay, like a plastic water bottle like you have here, fill it up with water, okay, not mineral water, but just usual tap water. And you can put it in the freezer for about an hour. You can take it out of your freezer very, very gently, so don't perturb it and move it sideways and so on. And then pour it into some cup and so on. And as you do that, it's hard to actually do. It takes, you won't always get it in the first try. You might actually try a few times to get it just right. If you wait too long, it freezes and before you get there and so on. So, but unless you can do it in principle, I mean, people have done it. You can actually see what it's been. And as you pour this water down, as it strikes the surface, it forms this column of ice. Okay, so there's some nucleation sites that's formed here, and whenever the supercooled water that appears here, once it strikes the surface, there's enough energy transmitted to it, it can overcome barriers and so on, it can start to nucleate. And, okay, so this thing can grow larger and larger and larger, and you get the idea. So this is really something that's around everywhere. And most of the ideas people will have in mind, typically, are of landscape. So here is some cartoon of one landscape and so on. And if you write down computer-generated glasses, so you write down some models of hard spheres or some particles interacting with some potentials and so on, that mimic some features of glasses, most of these systems have a very, very complicated energy landscape. So you can have many different states that have almost the same energy, and you can think about how quickly or how slowly you might go from one basin to another basin and so on. And this thing of going from one basin to another and so on, these dynamics that you have here, is of course not only for the glass problem, it appears in many other different problems. Even though it was initially inspired by glasses, the original theory was actually by Goldstein, was actually for glasses, but this concept has been since applied almost everywhere. So you can think about also spin glasses, optimization problems. So if you many computer problems that you want to see how long you have to wait to actually generate the right solution, how you want to anneal it and so on, you want to go from one state to another, do it in the right way, classical annealing, thermal annealing, I mean quantum annealing and so on. So all that is somehow to bypass or to allow yourself to ameliorate this problem that you have, that you face, but you have many, many minimum of it, almost share some energy, and you don't know where to actually go, and the dynamics are very, very slow. Here's another cartoon of a landscape, and there are many such cartoons on the web and so on, in different papers and so on, so hopefully you get the idea. Any questions about this? Okay, so before I talk about sort of my theory, I'll tell you give you two more slides about what people usually think about it, and I'll jump on to our ideas. But it would not be fair of me to do that without telling you what most people think actually occurs. So the typical picture, literally, that people have in mind is the following. It's a cartoon, of course, not to be taken too seriously. I mean, in my opinion. Is that you have some generalized coordinates describing your system, and you have some potential energy that you have for different states. And you can actually, if you are in the equilibrium, you could actually go down and crystallize. And this crystal has the lowest energy relative to anything else you can possibly imagine. Okay, so the ground state of the system is a transition invariant crystal. But if you cool things down very, very quickly and so on, you don't actually hit this thing in the right way, and you get lost somewhere else in space. And you can actually get lost in these complicated basins I just described in other cartoons I showed you earlier. And you might potentially go to this so-called ideal glass phase if you wait long enough, but you'll miss the true equilibrium lowest energy state of the system, which is the crystalline phase. That's a usual cartoon. And this is a sketch from a very famous paper from 24 years ago, science paper by Austin Angel, where he actually looked at the viscosities of different fluids. You cannot read it so well, but these are just different fluids here. And you see that this is basically one of the temperatures, the temperature at which you become the glass, divided by temperature itself. This is the viscosity. And you see that some fluids on this curve have a viscosity which looks like a straight line. A straight line would be an activated behavior. It would be a behavior in which viscosity scales as e to the power of some number in activation energy divided by temperature. So the logarithm would just be one of the temperature. These are so-called strong glasses. And you see that many other glasses actually have a dependence which is much more striking it basically, it sort of shoot, doesn't go up that fast, and all of a sudden the viscosity shoots up very, very rapidly for many decades. Okay, so people often think about these different glasses as being very, very different because they describe different systems, they have different properties and so on. And most theories try to explain one type or the other or to explain some similarity between them and so on. So let me just tell you about the most prominent fit and I'll jump on to our theory. So mostly the most common fit is to describe how the viscosity seems to diverge, it increases by many decades, is to say that its goal is like some constant, times e to the power of another constant, divided by temperature minus a positive number, a positive temperature. Okay, so this, if you believe this form has an essential singularity at temperature T equals to this value T naught, where this thing diverges, okay? And of course, this form really puts in by hand in singularity, and most people believe that actually at temperature T zero, if you could actually reach it, of course, it's very hard to do that, because it's basically impossible, viscosity would become infinite. But in principle, if you could reach it, have this ideal glass phase. That's a common, the most common. And most, even, and this fit has been around for many years, as you can sort of see. It's almost just a shy of a decade by now. But and most theories try to sort of explain why this indeed occurs. So basically, this is where things stand. I mean, there are many other theories I haven't mentioned, but this is sort of where things stand right now. So now let me jump to things, yeah.
It's a relation between the viscosity and the relaxation time?
Yeah, so one scales as the other. So
same.
It's basically scales, yeah. Okay. Basically
so all these arguments apply?
Yeah, so relaxation time scales in the same way. So thank you for that. The other questions that you have? Okay, so now let's start with afresh being naive. We're just going to start solve this as a quantum mechanical problem. So we write down the many-body Hamiltonian. So this is, of course, where it is. It's sort of useless because nobody can solve this. But it exists. So we have a Hamiltonian. We're just being mathematicians now. So it exists and it has some spectrum. So this is just the usual kinetic energy, potential energy, Coulomb's, maybe spin orbit, whatever you want to put there, it's all there. So it's just a scribe's system. And remember, an important feature that's here, there's no disorder. Okay, all these coupling, I mean, all these numbers that appear here and so on, there's no disorder in the system. It's all just what describes the usual crystal or fluid. It has no disorder. Or gas, if you go to high enough temperature and so on, it has no disorder. Now, this Hamiltonian has a spectrum, obviously, because it exists. And this spectrum, as for any other Hamiltonian, spans all the Hilbert space. So it doesn't matter how crazy of a state you give me, I can always expand that state in the eigenbasis of Hamiltonian. Okay? And that's, even though this is obvious, and we all know that, and it seems completely useless, because it's always there, it's actually very, very important to the way we're thinking about the problem. So instead of having, so you might think that, as most people do, that describing a system having lots and lots of false minima and so on is inherently different from describing a system like a crystal which has a well-defined order. But the point I want to emphasize is that all these different states, you can expand their density matrices and so on in terms of a complete basis defined by the Hamiltonian. Okay, so it doesn't matter how crazy the system is, if it has false minima, it doesn't have a false minima, it's irrelevant. I can, insofar as what I'm saying right now, you can always expand the states in that basis defined by the eigenbasis of the Hamiltonian. Now here in this cartoon, what I have is that just equally level, equal space levels. Of course, this is not harmonic oscillator, but this is only a cartoon. And what I will try to motivate for you momentarily is that if you go in high enough energy densities or high enough energies, then these states here, even though you cannot solve a spectral problem, okay, it's impossible to do as we all know, nonetheless, we can sort of prove that in high enough energy densities, the system, on average, I can say this on average, display delocalized liquid-like eigenstates. So the many-body eigenstates of a system, on average, are those of a fluid, have fluid-type properties. We cannot solve a problem analytically, but we can prove this nonetheless. If you go to low enough temperatures, low enough energy densities, more precisely, for a spectral problem, then unless you have a special fluid like helium-4 and ambient pressure and so on, if the system actually does crystallize at low enough temperatures, then at low enough energy densities, corresponding to lowest temperatures, the corresponding eigenstates would describe a crystal, maybe with phonons and so on, but basically would describe a crystal. And of course, most systems exhibit the first order transition, in which you have mixed coexistence of fluid and solid-like properties, which is this gray area here. It's only cartoon, of course. So I'm trying to motivate for you that all eigenstates that lie in this region, on average, of course, you can have different types, but on average, if I do an average of them, they have properties that are exactly those that you have from experimental measurements. Okay? So that's what I want to motivate for you right now. And how do we do that? Well, it's sort of really, really very, very simple. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to write down the average in any ensemble that you want to use in the equilibrium system. Let's imagine we use macrocanonical ensemble, so in some sense it's the cleanest, but it could do the same thing also for canonical ensemble, grand canonical ensemble, whatever ensemble is your favorite ensemble. Any observable that I look at, I think given an energy density E, so suppose I redo this in macrocanonical ensemble, which energy is a number, the quantity that I want to use is a well-defined quantity, is equal to the average of observable O over all eigenstates in some window of some size delta E. And this size of the window, importantly, does not scale with system size. So delta E is not of order N. Delta E is of order 1, or 1 times J, 1 times T, whatever you like to think about. But it's not something that scales with system size. Okay. And I just do an average. I just count how many states I have in this window. This is what this calligraphic N stands for. I sum over all the values of O, efficient values of O, for all eigenstates in this window. I divide, I find the average. And that's what appears, that's what the average is by definition in this ensemble. This is, of course, a definition. That's what we use is for calculations. Now, if you have equilibrium, we all know that what you actually measure in the equilibrium corresponds to what you compute in an ensemble appropriately describing that equilibrium. So you have a closed system, well-defined energy density. Okay, so not connected to any heat bath, it's just a closed system. For well-defined number of particles, well-defined volume. I use macrocanonical ensemble. What I measure in an experiment would coincide with what I calculate here. Usually, what we do is we solve this problem. We find the eigenstates, find this, divide by that, get some quantity, some function. Say we got this result for the ideal gas, or like us, or a far more complicated problem. And that's what we usually do. But of course, here we don't have this opportunity because this problem we are faced with right now is daunting. We can't calculate spectral properties of H. It's a three-dimensional problem. We have longer interactions. Obviously, we cannot do that. But it doesn't matter because we can go backwards. This quantity here, this is identical to what you measure in equilibrium. So this could be our input from experiment. This quantity right here, we can take from experiment, and that will inform us about what this quantity is. So instead of calculating the right-hand side, going to the left-hand side, now we set this quantity here on the left-hand side equal to what you have in equilibrium, and infer from that what is appears here on average on the right-hand side. Is this clear? Is logic clear? And of course, once you have that, you're done, because this quantity here on the left-hand side, if energy is large enough, if it's larger than energy density corresponding to that of melting, then it describes a fluid. So whatever I measure here, any observable I measure here would correspond to observable in the equilibrium fluid. And correspondingly, if I do an average of eigenstates in that window, any window of size, finite size, delta E, this average would also describe the same properties of the fluid exactly. So the eigenstates, high enough energy, correspond on average to those of a fluid, equilibrium fluid. Eigenstates, low enough energy, correspond to those of the equilibrium solid. Eigenstates in between correspond to a mixed coexistence phase, and so on. So you bypass the need to do a calculation because this is known from experiment. The same Hamiltonian we actually have is really the one describing a full bona fide experimental system. Okay, that's the basic idea. It's sort of in some sense, perhaps too simple and so on, but that's what we're going to use. So if energy density is large enough, the levels I have, energy density, which is larger than that of what you have in melting, then on average, not of, it doesn't have to have ETH hold and so on average, you have systems, the eigenstates describe the fluid, and conversely, if you're below that, you have a so-called solidus, and you describe the solid and so on, you have broken symmetries, and so you can actually label the eigenstates by the different quantum numbers or ergodic sectors and so on, associated with these broken symmetries if you occur, and so on. So that's the idea we're going to use. Is this clear? So we bypass, I repeat myself all too much, but this is important, we bypass the need to actually diagonalize any or do any approximation. Now let's think about it, what we do when we actually cool. So when we cool a system, is we take an initial state. Of course, we don't have pure wave functions. We have density matrices and so on. But to make it easy, let's think about a wave function. We have a system in a box described by some wave function. And I cool it down. How do I cool it down? I apply some fields and so on. I change a Hamiltonian in some way, which emulates exactly what happens in the experiment. So I have some Hamiltonian describing how the system actually evolves. And so this can be complicated. That doesn't really matter. The important thing is whatever this evolution operator is, it takes me from initial time before I cool down or heat up to the final time. This operator does that. Namely, it elevates the temperature of the system, elevates its energy density, or it lowers it if I cool it down and so on. And importantly, or perhaps you might say trivially, this Hamiltonian appearing at intermediate times, because it changed energy, obviously cannot be Hamiltonian. If I measure the energy by extension value of H, clearly, if energy changes, the way I evolve a system, its evolution operator, cannot commute of H. Okay, is this clear? I mean, it's obvious, but perhaps I just want to say it in a clear way. So this is, again, a very complicated problem, and you might say, what are the details of this? Is it open system, closed system? What BAF do you use? Do you use this equation? Do you use that equation? What approximation do you use? It doesn't really matter that much what I'm going to tell you. Because again, as I mentioned by now a few times, the eigenbasis of a Hamiltonian is a complete basis. So whatever I have at the end, the final state I have at the end, this final state, however complicated or simple it might be, I can always expand it in terms of the complete eigenbasis of the system. Okay? So my final state, I can then write down a combination of these eigenstates, and I know what these states do. I know what these states, if they correspond to high energy, describe a fluid. If they correspond to low energy, they correspond to solid, and so on. So these properties of these functions are known. What I don't know, of course, and have no clue, what these guys are. But this is, of course, certainly true. Yeah?
You know the two extremes, right? It's either liquid light or
yes.
Light.
Yes.
What about in energy ranges close to the melting?
Yeah, so you have coexistence. So again, if you do a measurement, when you have mixed coexistence of liquid and solid, then you see indeed mixed coexistence of liquid and solid. So that means if I, at that temperature which I have mixed coexistence, at that corresponding energy density, if I do an average over that interval, I would find out precisely the properties I measure. So basically, the eigenstates, the average of eigenstates themselves, has to coincide with what I have as a mixed solid fluid type property. So basically, eigenstates themselves, the set of eigenstates themselves in that window emulates the average of that set, and that's exactly what happens in the real system.
Are you saying the details of H tilde don't really matter for your argument?
No.
But don't they have to be kind of long range to establish these?
No. I mean,
if they're short range, then you can't establish.
Okay. You're right. So it has to be, the form such that you couple strongly enough to all the sites in the system, such that the overall temperature goes down. You can actually see it go down. If you couple, let's say, only if you have a big, huge layer of ice, and you only couple to the topmost layer or infinite layer of ice, and you only couple to the topmost layer, obviously temperature would not budge. Energy will not change. So it has to be that overall, whatever you have, phonons, whatever you have, or photons, they couple to a finite fraction of the volume. So overall, the temperature goes down to where you can actually measure experimentally. Sorry. Okay, so that's that. And the same thing, of course, can be done. That's the matrices, of course. It's not really easy to say that, but of course it's true. Powers with flashy stuff. So now, let's go back to our wave function. Remember, the wave function, or density matrix, could be written down in terms of eigenstates of the system. And typically, in equilibrium, we have delta functions. So typically, in equilibrium, as I told you, or remind you in the beginning, you only probe energy eigenstates in a very, very narrow window. So typically, if I were to write down this quantity, it's the probability of having an energy E. I just sum moduli squared and so on, up to the value squared. I look at when I have an energy E and so on. Typically, this quantity, especially when you develop energy density, energy per particle, or a given volume, would be of a delta function characteristics. But of course, there's no theorem telling you it must be. Okay? But generically, what you have is that you have some probability profile. It might be that this profile has all of its support, all of its weight, at energies above melting. In which case, of course, you only sample states high enough energy density that correspond to the fluid, or even gas if you're even higher in the atmosphere. Or it could be that the energy density associated with this quantity would have only significant amplitudes associated with energies lower than that of the so-called solid temperature or energy scale. But basically, this whole thing is just a solid phase. It might be phonons roaming around and so on, but it's basically a solid. In which case, you just probe only the solid eigenstates. But generically, of course, you could have both. You could have it, this profile, this function, could allow you to have some weight, a source of low energy eigenstates corresponding to the solid phase, could have some weight, a source of high energy eigenstates corresponding to the fluid phase. You could have also eigenstates which lie in between, corresponding to a mixed coexistence phase and so on. So generically, you can have a non-trivial function. And this function is really my principal aim. I want to sort of argue that this function does not need to be a delta function. Okay? If it were a delta function, we just get equilibrium results because you just sample what happens in a very narrow window, and all averages would coincide with equilibrium. Unless, of course, you pick special eigenstates and so on, weight them differently. So this is what these profiles I had before mean. So I plot here along the horizontal axis, this function. So this integral of this quantity overall is a value of 1. This is a bad cartoon, but the point is here, if I have low temperatures, I probe only states of low energy densities. If I have high energy densities, I would probe states of high energy densities. A profile that I would have would be somewhere here. If I have energy density corresponding to, on average, about a group of melting, or somewhere in this interval, it will be some profile that you have here, and so on. So as I cool the system down, whatever this profile is, its function is it goes down, but it can have a non-trivial width, okay, a priori. It might have, that width might be 0, but a priori that width might be non-zero. And so you have, so in this case, let's say here, some of the weight associated with liquid type states, these guys here, these eigenstates on average are fluid. So it corresponds to solid type eigenstates, and some of the weight associated with mixed coexistence states. So that's a picture, literally. Any questions about this? Okay, so now let me show you that this can indeed occur. So even though we typically think about things always being delta functions and so on, and justified by appeal to various Schumann theorems and so on, which of course have always some limitations. You have to read, of course, any theorem that we actually have has conditions that we have to be fulfilled in order to actually apply that theorem. So let me show you that I can actually write down very simple systems which provably have a finite width. So this is only a toy example, which is an example you can actually work out and sort of see that it can actually occur. Suppose you have a Hamiltonian, which is on any graph or any lattice you want to think about. It doesn't have to be 1D. It can be any dimension you want to think about. And you think about some generic spin Hamiltonian, which has two parts. It has a part in which we apply a field along some axis, z-axis, coupling to the spins, okay? And you have any other symmetric Hamiltonian that you add to it. It could be usual Heisenberg, it can be four-spin interactions, higher spin interactions, and so on. But the point is that this quantity, this one here is SE2 symmetric. So the simplest case that you can think about, of course, is just that of Heisenberg type interactions, so basically just a two body interaction. So on the range could be infinite or finite, it doesn't matter for purposes of argument. Okay. So how do I cool heat up a system? Of course, I can do it many different ways, but let's make it easy, where we can actually calculate things exactly. Let's imagine what I do is I apply a transverse field. So this field is along the z-axis. Let's imagine we apply a field on the y-axis. So what happens? What happens, as you know very well, when you apply a field along the direct transverse to this one, the spins precess. So if you have a spin aligned along the z-axis, it has some projection along the z-axis, the spins will precess, Larmor precess about the applied field direction. And as a result of that, the average 5SZ will change, and this piece will change its magnitude, up or down, depending on how it processes and how long we actually wait. This piece does not change one bit. Why? Because it's symmetric. This piece is invariant on any rotation you can think about, including the Larmor precession. So it doesn't change one bit. So this piece changes. This one doesn't. So overall, the energy changes only as a result of this term. Okay, and it can go up or down depending on how the details of the system. Okay. Now, as you know very well, on general graphs and lattices, and Bohr dimensions especially, we can now do beta ansatz and so on. Not so exactly whatever tricks we usually use and so on. It's a really hard problem. But now let's sort of go through. So what you can actually do is you can write down the eigenstates. The eigenstates that you have will be of this form. The real difficulty is finding out what these quantum numbers mu are. But what you do know, even without doing this, is that this eigenstate can be labeled by these two quantum numbers, the total value of S and SZ. Why? Because this piece is SZ2 symmetric. So clearly, all of its eigenstates can be specified by S total and SZ. Okay, you can diagonalize H-sim with both S squared and SZ, obviously. And this, obviously, as well, I can specify what this thing in terms of these quantum numbers. Okay. Now, of course, really what I have is I have many, many different sectors. I have a huge number of sectors. I have to diagonalize in that sectors. I have to find new combinations that are correct. To diagonalize a full Hamiltonian, that's an impossible problem to do. But it doesn't matter for me, because we can coordinate calculate what happens when we have a precession. So not to bore you with details, let me just give you what the result is. If you actually do a calculation, which is not terribly hard, and just process, so that's the origin of this angle that you actually have here. So the longer you wait, the more you process. The energy density changes, okay, and so does the width. This goes up and down depending on how long you wait and so on, how you plot your fields. It will go up and down in a sizable way only if SZ is of order of n. Okay, if SZ is of order 0, SZ is over n, system size, number of spins, is of order 0, this will not change. You process, but it doesn't matter because you have a value of SZ is just basically almost 0. But if SZ is of size n, as like Fermilab states and so on, or just state, of course, this will be not, then you can actually achieve heating or cooling at the finite rate, and this will be non-zero. And if you calculate the width, you'll find it's given by this. Okay, so importantly, if you can actually cool heat up a system down by applying this field, see what the width generically will be of order 1. S total divided by n is some quantity of order 1. Okay, so this quantity, S total divided by n is not 0, it's a quantity of order 1. You can have special states. For instance, you can have all spin polar, if you have, started with all spins being polarized on one axis, this will be 0. But generically, it will not be 0. And you can apply other fields and so on. You can just tag on something along. I should emphasize what I'm doing here is not adiabatic. Okay, so I'm not changing things slowly. I'm just turning on a field and changing what happens. And as a result of that, energy density goes down in a sizable way, and the width becomes non-trivial. So I don't want to bore you with details. Maybe I should skip this. But the point is, you have many, many different spins. Let's say spin 1/2, last site. You add them up all together. Of course, it's a nightmare, but you can actually calculate how many sectors you actually have when you write down this tensor product of what you actually have in terms of the total value of S total. So it's given by this. And importantly, even though many sectors will be of total spin 0 or total spin, which is of order 0 and divided by n. Importantly, you will have many states in which S total will be n, as if you have ring states and so on, which will either be low energy states for ferromagnets, or it could be high energy states for anti-ferromagnets, but they always, of course, be eigenstates. Yeah.
So isn't the change in energy depends only on SZ total?
It depends on S total and SZ, yeah. The SZ, the initial value SZ.
So all states with the same S total.
No, it doesn't. So in the equation here, I skipped through it, but this W is a ratio of SZ to S total. So this W appears here, sorry, this little W that appears here is a ratio of S total to SZ to S total. So if you have a fully polarized state, this is a value of 1 or minus 1. But if it's not a fully polarized state, it's not a value. So if it's a fully polarized state, this is a value of 1, S total is of order n, this is just 0, if nothing happens. So if you have a product state, nothing happens. The width that you have a distribution is just 0, as you can prove using some potential theorem, because you have a product state. Variances just add up, and it's just a usual thing. But once you go away from this limit of this being plus or minus 1, then actually, because you have an entanglement, essentially, then this will not be should be 0, it would be finite. And you can also calculate the distribution itself by just doing it brute force, and I'm not going to bore you with details. But what you find in this example, for instance, is that you will have a distribution of this type. So it looks a lot like what you have for a so-called Wigner semicircle law for random matrices, but of course nothing is random here. We didn't know anything about randomness because it was a real physical system. This quantity here, which typically describes the distribution that you have for a Wigner's distribution, now appears in the denominator, not the numerator. Okay, and you have a finite width here. The width is bounded, and that's because for spins, the energy that you actually have in this case is bounded. Operators are bounded, so it has to have a finite width. And that'd be all. You can map this problem onto other problems. For instance, you can map, as you know very well, any spin 1/2 problem onto hardcore bosons. So you can write down an S plus, a raising operator for a spin, as a creation operator of hardcore boson. You can write down S minus, a lowering operator for value of SZ, as a destruction operator, annihilation operator for a hardcore boson. The number operator up to trivial linear transformation just becomes a value of SZ. And you can map 1 to 1 in a rigorous fashion any Hamiltonian describing a spin 1/2 system to any Hamiltonian describing hardcore bosons. And so if you do that, the same conclusions would hold verbatim for a system like this. You have hardcore bosons hopping on a lattice or graph, any dimension you want to think about, and you have this Kepler potential that varies in this way. And if you vary this and give rise to a non-trivial finite rate, the same thing would apply. And this theory for bosons, you can write down in terms of what it would correspond to for a field theory. So if you would do the continuum limit, we just describe scalar phi 4 field theory. So this suggests that if you have canonical field theories to start off with and you quench them in a non-trivial way, you might have all of the above effects, namely that you have a finite width and you might have long-range correlations. Yeah.
If I understood correctly, you emphasize that if you do non-adiabatic, you kick the system like non-adiabatically, and you get a spread in the energy density.
Exactly.
So for this system of spins, is it possible to see from this expression that in the limit of adiabatic evolution,
it's trivial. You get 0. Nothing happens because you follow the eigenstate. So you start with an eigenstate, you vary the thing adiabatically, you follow a new eigenstate in Hamiltonian, you vary it. And if you go back to where it started from, you just go from this eigenstate, and I'd say here, you just go down to your Hamiltonians, you come back to your Hamiltonian. Energy changes in the beginning at the end is 0. The spread here is 0, the spread here is 0. Nothing changes. If you have some finite spread here, it will map exactly to where it started from. So adiabatically, nothing will happen. It's all non-adiabatic.
I'm a bit confused how I get the long-range correlation from evolving with a short-range Hamiltonian for finite time.
Because of entanglement. So basically, yeah, I mean, in a nutshell, the answer to the question is because of entanglement.
Okay.
So even though we don't see it, and typical thermal states have volume law entanglement. Okay, so we don't see it. Usually what we measure is sort of local things decay and so on, because it's sort of diagonalized in our basis. But once you actually shift your basis by driving the system, then these long range correlations come to life and you can actually see them. But once it thermalizes again, you don't see it. It just decays very quickly in space. I'm not sure if I answered your question, but that's, let me put it this way. This will not happen if things will not entangle. If you have a product state, nothing will happen. It's true.
So thermal states are
eigenstate with definite value of S del total.
What then?
An eigenstate.
Yes.
Before you turn on this precession field.
Yes.
That's a definite value of S del total.
Exactly.
And then if your initial state is one of those eigenstates.
Exactly.
Then you turn on this precession field.
Exactly.
Then there's no spreading energy, right? There's still.
No, you do have spreading.
You have
spreading. Yes, you have spreading.
Why is it? I thought.
Because yeah, I cannot give you a nice word to say it.
I can give you a simple one. Because your original Hamiltonian contains a field in the z direction, right? So the energy of the state depends on kind of the polarization in the z direction. If you then start to process, right?
Yeah.
If I start, for example, pointing upwards in z direction, and I start to process downwards,
as the total will process by same.
The energy of the original Hamiltonian. That's what I mean by energy, not the expectation value of the Hamiltonian that you use for the time evolution. But the original Hamiltonian, which only contains like these SE2 symmetric terms, and the z field, the expectation value of that thing changes because you point in a different z direction.
If I
know
the S-total,
check it by saying a lot. Let me elaborate what Luke said. I mean, you can see it in different ways. Of course, the real way to do it is to do a calculation. But suppose you actually do it in a rotating frame, so to speak. So now you go from Z, whatever it was initially, to Z prime. So. But you want to evaluate what happens in the original Z frame. Okay. So now, if you actually want to calculate, say, the variance that you have associated with Z prime, imagine, make it simple. Suppose you just rotate until you go to the, you rotate enough to actually go to the XY plane. Okay, so now basically SZ average is equal to zero. And you know that the average value of SX squared, average value of SY squared are the same by symmetry. That would correspond basically, so the average value of SX squared plus the average value of SZ squared plus the variation that you have in SZ squared, which is just SZ itself squared, is equal to S operator squared. Okay, but this quantity is of order n. So S squared is of order n. S total is of order n. And it's equal to SX squared plus SY squared plus SZ squared. SX squared corresponds to the variance that you have. SZ prime now points along X. The average value of SX is zero, but SX squared average is not zero. It corresponds to a half of S operator squared, Casimir operator S squared, minus SZ squared. And that's non-zero. That goes like N squared. And the same thing could be done in any time that you stop it. You could just stop at any, but the same calculation is exactly the same. So that's basically where it comes from.
So out of time, could you go to...
Yeah, of course. Yeah, so I don't want to take your time too much. So basically, you can do the same thing using uncertainty relations. If you can write down a system and having copying it to a BAF, you can evolve it. As you know very well, if you have any two operators, A and B, they always satisfy these uncertainty relations, also if you mix state. And if you have a system in which coupled to a BAF and one operator, A corresponds to the small subsystem, and B corresponding to the BAF, all the couplings that you have and so on, from BAF to the system, this equation, of course, still holds. And what it will give rise to, I have no time to go through this now, but what it gives rise to is basically, it gives you a lower bound on the product of uncertainties, the width. So the width and the energy density of a small system from the width and the energy density of a big system is bound from below by the commutator. But the commutator is just a derivative. If you have any commutator with any quantity of a Hamiltonian, that gives you a derivative of that quantity. And so if you look at the commutator between the small subsystem of Hamiltonian to the large BAF, everything else, that's equal to the change of energy of a small system. So basically, if you drive a system at a finite rate, and this is of order n, this left-hand side must be also of order n. And if you have a closed system, which is ultimately is an equilibrium, and on average is long enough times and so on, long enough averages describes equilibrium, you can make a kind of ensemble. This uncertainty is of order one, mandating this uncertainty is of order one. Is this clear? So basically, the uncertainty relations themselves mandate that you have spreading. Of course, you don't know how large or small it is, but it's not zero. Okay, is this clear? So it's just a consequence of uncertainty relations. It's like a time energy uncertainty relations, but now instead of having some arbitrary operator A, which we usually think about, now we have two Hamiltonians, one for a small system, one for the largest. Okay, I don't want to go too long, I don't want to be impolite. So basically, usually when you drive a system, after you drive it, it almost immediately goes to equilibrium, especially if it's a small molecule or something, it fermions almost instantly. But if you have a large system, that collapse onto having equilibrium state is not guaranteed at all. And it could be that you have to wait a very, very long time before you actually equilibrate and have a sharp, intensive variable of energy density. So basically, I should just sketch for you setting open systems and so on. And the point is, I'll just say it in words, you can calculate any observable you want to think about in terms of a distribution, and you know what happens in equilibrium. And when you do that, you can derive what happens for long-time averages, and you can basically derive this curve I showed you earlier for viscosity. So you can calculate the viscosity in many different ways, but the way you actually measure it experimentally, the most common, the oldest way, is take a sphere and drop it into a bucket. The sphere has radius r, there's a gravitational acceleration free fall, of course, g, little g, there's some viscosity eta that you actually want to measure, the mass density of a sphere in the surrounding fluid, and then terminal velocity that you have of a dropping sphere is given by 1 over the viscosity. And this quantity you can actually calculate by using what I just skipped, but I have no time to describe it to you, but you basically calculate the average value, long-term average of the velocity of some sphere, let's say if you had appended it to describe your system. And if you do that and use a Gaussian distribution for reasons that I can describe to you, you'll find out, so you can actually sort of derive a Gaussian. You'll find out, if you plug in the Gaussian distribution, the viscosity will have this form. And this quantity here describes the width, the smearing of the distribution. So we have a non-trivial width. That width, I assume, is somewhat conformal. It has no scale. It's some number of, which is dimensionless, times temperature. It's only scale in the problem. Okay, so I just replace this by that. And this is a prediction, then you can actually go and compare it to the data, which is what I showed you in the beginning. And that's the whole idea. Yeah.
So main assumptions here for what you've shown is you need non-adiabatic unitary evolution.
Yes, exactly.
On a closed system.
Closed or open? Yeah. Open also would hold. I can get balance for open system as well.
But then when you have an open quantum system, you have like non-unitary evolution.
Yeah. So but the same thing would happen. So let me show you how that would occur. So if you have an open system, what would happen is that you would have, if you have, say, a subsystem, your system, your true system surrounded by a BAF, which in its own surrounded by some larger BAF and so on, then the uncertainty relations still hold, okay? And also for mixed states, okay? And if you plug in what you have in equilibrium, so suppose a small system is equilibrium with a larger system, equilibrium with larger heat BAF and so on, so you can basically use what you have for equilibrium systems with temperature T, with the corresponding heat capacities, what you would find out is that if you drive a system too fast, faster than what you have here on the right-hand side, the width would be non-vanishing. I mean, it's not self-consistent. You cannot remain in vanishing sharp densities if the variation of energy is large enough. So that's it. I took the time, probably way too much, but that's basically the point. And that's how we derived these forms I showed you in the beginning. So maybe I'll just end there. I'll just show you that slide and then I'll stop. You can get there. Anyway, I apologize for this. But anyway, that's it. That's the idea.
Thanks.
Yeah.
If there's a spread in energy, it would mean that if you measure the, like if an experimentalist measure the internal energy of a system, every time you progress a system, you would find a different energy.
Not necessarily. Because there are two different, it's a very, very good question. But the eigenstates have a distribution. I mean, basically, if you decompose the eigenstates, you have a distribution. But if you look at the eigenvectors of a density matrix, they might all have the same energy. So basically, what I'm trying to say is that the density matrix eigenvectors are superpositions of the eigenstates. They correspond to what you have, the position of eigenstates themselves of a Hamiltonian. And it's not just one eigenstate of Hamiltonian, it's a superposition of, all, of many of them. And it's such that overall, the average value is the same for all the high probability eigenstates of density matrix. They all have the same energy. So you can thermalize and have a unique value, almost a unique value, energy itself, even though you superpose many, many different eigenstates together to attain that state.
Yeah, but I mean, that is the theory usually that thermal states as we know them have that, but then the width is...
Right.
Is scaling as like
square root of n. Exactly. But here, but
if you say the width is square, scaling at square root, but not at square root, is n itself, then
exactly.
You would expect that you can find macroscopic energy fluctuations.
Yeah, it doesn't follow. I agree for something bothered me for a long time. But you can have situations where the corresponding, so I have a density matrix is non trivial. I have corresponding eigenvectors with density matrix. I'm not sure what I should call them, maybe it's a bad notation, but I basically eigenvectors themselves, they can write down these in terms of the computer of states. And usually when we do this in equilibrium, these are peaked about what I have in equilibrium, and the distribution of this is very, very narrow. It scales the square root of n, it's exactly as you were saying. But it doesn't have to be like that. It can be that I have a set of these guys, such as overall, if I evaluate the Hamiltonian in these states, this is important. These wave functions, psi I, and so on, they're just right in this way. So these are important wave functions that have a high weight in the probability density. They all share the same energy. So basically, if I evaluate psi I, h psi I, this corresponding value of EI doesn't change significantly as I scan across different eigenvectors of rho. Those that have high weight, it doesn't follow. Now, but this distribution, of course, would have implications, not only for the viscosity, but also for other quantities. For instance, if you measure not the variation of the total global energy density itself, but locally what you actually have, you might expect that H should appear there in some way. And indeed, it does. So, I mean, maybe not for reasons of the theory, but empirically it does. If you look at the energy density fluctuations that you have locally in the supercooled fluids, they're sizable. So you have fast-moving regions, you have slow-moving regions. The system is not uniform. So it's so-called heterogeneous. I mean, there's dynamical heterogeneities, the size of which can be of order of typically 10, some cases 10% of the energy, average energy itself. Which is, by the way, the same scale that we actually have here. So this number that I have is the dimensionless number A bar, on average is about 8%, like scanned across all fluids. This is just numerology, it doesn't mean anything. But it just it's consistent with that.
Thanks, Jordan.